Well, I have above me a rope that represents the story of God, the never-ending story of God. This story actually goes all the way through the screen, all the way through the wall, through the parking lot, through AutoZone, over to Revolution Fitness, up to 71. I think it keeps going up to Columbus, away and away and away. It goes and goes and goes. In fact, beyond Columbus, beyond Canada, Iceland, Greenland, whoever's up there, it keeps going on. And somewhere over the sphere of the earth, it is anchored someplace, so the mind can't even fathom where it is. It is the very beginning of all that is in the mind of God. And it goes all the way through here, all the way through this screen, through this wall, down Madison Road, past Withrow, through Cincinnati, all the way to Kentucky, on and on, all the way down to South America. Go, 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 away, away. In fact, it's tied to the back of a jet plane. And this jet plane not only goes, it's invented by God, it not only goes the speed of sound, it actually goes the speed of light. It goes away and away and away, on and on and on. Though as much as we can think, God is expanding all that is and going forever and ever. This is all that God has ever done, all that God is doing, all that God will ever do. It is the story of God. And we took a look last week at the story of God as it related to Act 2, how he created the world and how he did things inside of the world. There was a story of God that happened long before the earth took place, but the story that we're in, or the chapter, the theme, takes place right here on planet Earth. Long before Earth ever existed, the story was taking place. Whether this thing was created 6,000 years ago, or whether this was billions of gazillions years ago that started with a big bang, either way, it's just a little slice of what all that God has already done and all that he will yet to do. And so we looked at how God created this earth, and first day he did this, and it was good, and the second day this, and it was good, and the third day it was this, and it was good, and the fourth day, went on and paralleled all those things. And one of the days, day six, God creates Adam, and it's the only time where God creates or reformats or restores, as we looked at last week, and God doesn't say it's good. It's the only time. It's because Adam was alone. God is a being who dwells in community, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. He is a being that calls us to community, and as we're going to see today, he's a being that is building a community, a nation, a holy nation, that's named Israel, that we're able to be grafted into. And so when he creates Eve, now they are a community. God always works in a community, and they rebel. They say to God, God, I don't want to be a part of your story. I don't care what you think. I want to be the center of all that is. I want to have that fruit over there. I want what I want. And so when they take of that fruit, they rebel. And where we left things last week was in the midst of darkness, was in the midst of blackness, was in the midst of rebellion. We need to sit in the bad news. We need to sit in the bad news that we don't impress God with our beliefs, we don't impress God with our actions, that we are fallen, tainted people. And I'll say it again. I am broken. Brian Tome is broken. In fact, to use a four-letter word, I sin. I sin. I have problems. I misperceive things. I do things that I know God doesn't even want me to do, knowing and presuming upon his forgiveness. I'm a broken person who fails God regularly. Last week after the 10 o'clock service, I walked off stage and there was applause. It was actually the only time I've been applauded in 15 years here at Crossroads. It was very strange to me. I walked off stage. I thought, that is really weird. I had a hard time understanding that. 11:45 service at Oakley, it happened again. This time I was ready. I walked off and I stopped and I came back and I said, why are you clapping? Why are you clapping? My opinion is you're clapping because you don't see this applies to you. You're excited somebody else got taken to the tool shed. Oh, yes, good. Get him. Sick him. Oh, good. And I said, you know, you ought to think about yourself. And I turned off stage, just walked off stage. It was a nice ending to the weekend. It really was. And that was after I had already chastised them. And same in here, part of our sinfulness is that we habitually show up late. Part of our sinfulness is we're rude to people around us by not being able to manage our schedules and coming in on time. And all of us do various things, but I to hit that real hard at the 11:45, but we have some of those issues here as well, 10 o'clock, the last two services. I don't know what that is, but it's a more example of our brokenness. In fact, you might be upset that I brought that up because of your brokenness. You're upset that I brought that up. And when I got criticized for what I said, I readily admitted to some people on email, you know what, I could have totally misinterpreted the applause. You know why I could have misinterpreted it? Because I'm broken. Because I don't properly interpret data. I think I know the truth, but I know oftentimes I don't. I think that people are thinking one thing, but I'm not omniscient. I don't know. You know, I regularly admit that I misunderstand things. It's part of my brokenness. All of us are in this place. God actually got hit in the mouth. He got hurt. His created beings rebelled against him. Whenever a dog or something less than me rebels against me, I get upset. We all get upset. But none of us have even created a dog or a cat. Imagine God, he's created us, and the ones that have been created by him actually said to him, you know what, I don't care what you say. I want to do it my way. I want to be the center of the story. Mike Tyson, when he was the height of his physical prowess, the height of the boxing game, and challenger after challenger came in and was knocked out, and one of them came in and said, I got a plan, and someone asked Mike Tyson at a press conference what he was going to do with this challenger, and here's what Mike Tyson said. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Actually, what he said was, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. The most manly man ever with the most girly voice I've ever heard. Amazing, amazing stuff. But it's totally true. Well, here's what happened. God got punched in the mouth. Bam. Now what with the plan? And we see God's faithfulness. Today, we're going to start turning the corner. We should be dwelling a bit in the bad news and the difficulty of last week. But man, at the same time, there is a faithful God who perseveres. The strange thing about God is he accommodates our sinfulness. His faithfulness causes him to accommodate our sinfulness. The very first being that is killed in the Bible is killed by God. He actually goes and he kills an animal. Adam and Eve, as a result of their sinfulness, are not trusting one another. They're trying to hide things from one another. They're not speaking truthfully to one another. And so they take fig leaves as a sign of a vulnerability, not wanting to be open. God sees a fig leaf and says, I know you guys aren't as creative as I am. Let me tell you something. There's a much better way to clothe yourselves. He kills an animal, strips the animal of its hide, and makes clothes. This is a crazy thing when you understand this. God accommodated their choice and actually blesses them beyond. This is amazing how God is. And actually, the shedding of blood is going to be a theme that's going to continue on in a greater degree. And we, as a part of the American story, oftentimes have a hard time with the Bible because in our American story, shedding of blood is always bad. Very few of us have ever eaten anything that we've killed. Blood seems nasty. It seems primal. It seems backward. And that's because we view all of God through the lens of the American story. And today we're going to have to get out of our cultural elite mentality and see that God works in other cultures and other time periods. And just because of the way it is in America doesn't mean it's right. And this is part of why we misunderstand God, because we keep expecting God to be a 21st century American, and he's not. The story of God is much bigger than what's happening in our slice of time. So as God faithfully executes on his plan, he goes out and he starts small. He identifies a nomad who's wandering around in the Middle East. His name is Abram, who's later to be called Abraham. And he decides to build a community through him, to build a nation through him, to build a family through him, to build a household through him. And here's what he says. It's actually become one of the rallying verses here for our community, Crossroads. He says this in Genesis chapter 12. The Lord God said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples of the earth will be blessed through you. Does I have a plan? My plan is to still bless the earth, everybody who is in it. And my plan starts with you. I'm going to start small and faithfully expand your household, your family. In the ancient world, and actually many parts of the world today, your family was anybody who was attached to your household. Anybody who worked for you, anybody you adopted in, anybody who was your kid, anybody who's just part of the overall encompassing part of your domain. And he said, I'm going to start with you, and I'm actually give you your own blood, your own seed, to you and Sarah, and from this, there is going to be a future. Great things are going to happen. I love at Crossroads that we're starting to really live out this verse. We want to be a blessing to our city. We want to be a blessing to our world. And I thought it was fascinating a couple weeks ago when we announced that our next site is going to be in Florence. We have a site in Oakley, a site in Mason, and soon a site in Florence, a while, I've got to build it out. I thought it was amazing as I watched some of the news reports on it, how political officials in Florence were saying things like, this is great, we're excited Crossroads is coming, it won't affect our traffic flow, it's going to be good for our community. It was as if they were saying, hey, we get an IKEA, yay. Yay, we get a Bass Pro Shops, yay. Hey, we get an REI, yay. It was as if they said, yay, we get a Crossroads, wonderful, wonderful. Why is that? I think it's because we as a community team are building a reputation of blessing people, whether it's all of us here with free coffee, helping all of us grow spiritually, whether it's kids who need tutoring, whether it's people in poverty, whatever it is, there's a theme of blessing that's going around us. And this is always the way it is with God when he works with communities of people and expands them, because God faithfully gives hope. He faithfully gives hope. He faithfully gives hope to Adam and Eve by saying, you know, I'm not forgetting about you. Here's some clothes, just this sign that I still am going to do something in and through. I'm going to faithfully give you hope. He says to Abraham, I'm going to faithfully give you hope and faithfully give you future. And to do this, he puts a sign. He puts a sign. Many of us have signs on us, like we've got a wedding ring as a sign to a commitment to somebody we're married to. I rarely wear mine because my knuckles is odd. But some of us have a sign inside of an office or at home that we actually made a commitment and actually finished school, and that diploma shows that it's a sign of it. Some of us have a major event that's happened in our life, and we got a tattoo to mark the moment. It's a sign. It reminds us of something. And God wants to give Abraham a sign of this. So he says, for you and every other male that's going to be in your household, I want you to get circumcised. Abraham goes, what's that? What's that? Now, it's interesting that God in his omniscience and creative ability actually captured this on video, and archaeologists have dug this up. Actually dug it up in a DVD long before video cameras were even invented. So we have a little snapshot of what that looked like. And while we look at that, we're going to have the opportunity to be generous. If you're newer here today, hopefully you're experiencing our generosity. If you've been around for a while, you know this is how we're a blessing to all of us, a blessing to the city, to our world. So that's why we're generous, whether it's cash or checks in a fuddy-duddy bag it's going to come by, or electronic giving. It's just an example of us wanting to be faithful to honoring God with our finances and his generosity. So while we have volunteers pass around little strange bags, let's take a look at that video that was unearthed. After last week, I'm taking humor any way I can get it. I can't, you know. This is strange. There's many things that are in the Bible or in God's story that you might have heard before and you just gloss over and say, oh yeah, so that happened. No, this is strange. This is really odd. Why this? I'm sure Abraham was saying, couldn't I have like a secret decoder ring or something? Why have that? We don't know exactly why, but I think it's interesting to think about it in light of what any guy would have thought of under the conditions that he saw his penis. There's three times you see your penis. When you procreate, it would have been a reminder. Would remind us, we would procreate, when you urinate, possibly a reminder of your humanity. And the third thing, when you measure things. Those are the things that anybody. I'm sorry. Okay. But honestly, on the procreation thing, that's one of the things that happened. It was a time that when Abraham and any guy in his household would remember when they looked at something's different here, God, and you are doing something different in and through me. You are reproducing your hope and doing something in us. And this idea of giving hope, giving a future promise, a future plan, is a theme that goes throughout the Bible and a theme that should go throughout our minds if we're a part of God's story. Later on, the nation of Israel expands, it has gotten large, has gotten mighty, but yet in the midst of very, very hard times, one of the prophets, Jeremiah, comes to the nation of Israel in Jeremiah 29 and says this, God says this through him, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and give you a future. verse I think about regularly when I'm down or when things seem to not be going my way. But the way to think about this verse accurately is to realize that God isn't looking at all of us as individuals and saying, you, I'm going to give you hope and go forward. But there's nothing wrong with thinking that in the right circumstances. But the obvious context of this is you plural in the midst of community. You plural in the midst of a holy nation that God is calling out. And part of why we don't see the story of God is because everything within America, within our story, is all about the individual. It's about the individual, where what God is speaking to is the context of community. Regularly it does, whether it's himself, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Adam and Eve, Abraham and the nation of Israel. He is about, in his story, creating a community, a holy nation that later on the Bible talks about this nation is expanded beyond people who even have Jewish DNA to people who are followers of his son. Now, let's go back to where we started here with Abraham. Abraham gets this promise that he is going to have children. Amazing stuff that he's living in this. 24 years later, no kids. 24 years later, no kids. Now, he's expanded his household because more people have come into his house, and he's actually had kids with his wife's maidservant, which was a cultural thing that people did at that time, and God at that point decided not to speak against that. So he's got a larger household, but this vision was always supposed to be his own seed. That's the way it came to him. And so he's probably forgotten about it. He figures maybe God is a forgetful person, or maybe God isn't faithful. Maybe he says one thing and he doesn't do it. 24 years later, God visits him again. It's like there's a long period of silence. Oftentimes we feel silence from God. It isn't that God has left. There's just something else he's doing. And God comes to him again and says, you're going to have your own child out of your seed. And Abraham laughs. Actually says in the account that he actually falls on the ground laughing. We would call this R-O-F-L. I think that's it, right? Rolling on the floor. Okay, fine, got it. Yeah, rolling on the floor laughing. When we see R-O-F-L, it's like, oh, great stuff. Amazing. So glad to hear that. And this is what happens with Abraham. He falls down. Like, oh, my gosh, it's still going to happen? Awesome, God, awesome. And he goes and tells Sarah. Sarah laughs too, but we get the picture that it's a different kind of laughter. It's almost a laughter of derision. She says, oh, yeah, yeah. And am I going to have a child now that the way of women has ceased inside of me? It's a nice way to say, now that I've stopped menstruating, now that I'm not having a cycle, I don't know if you know or not, Abraham, you really can't have kids when that happens. Well, yeah, right. Yeah, right. I'm going to have a kid. And what do you know? God miraculously provides them with a son. His name is Isaac. They name him Isaac because that is the Hebrew word for laughter. It reminds them of the faithfulness of God. Whether they are in joy laughing or in derision laughing, they can't deny the fact that God faithfully gives hope. He faithfully provides. And every time they call their son's name, they remember marking of the moments of their reaction to God's faithfulness. Now, time goes on, Tamar marches on, Isaac gets circumcised, they continue to grow their family, and God comes to him and gives him a very strange command that we're going to spend the rest of our time on. It comes from the book of Genesis chapter 22. This is a story that I didn't really realize was as central to the Bible or as central to the story of God until I went over to Israel several years ago. And I found out at Jewish sites and at quote-unquote Christian sites, whether it was synagogues or churches or just town squares, this story is depicted everywhere. Chiseled into stone, put onto windows, carved into wood doors. It is everywhere. It's a central story to the ancient Middle East, to understanding God and his story. And here's where it goes, Genesis 22. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. Ooh, really? Wow. This is a hard one. And we also understand this is a hard one, especially for us, because there's many things in the story of God and the original context that are completely outside of our American context. And we judge the story of God. We judge God because we can't help but think of it through our cultural context. And today, we're going to have to get out of our elitism. If you assume everything should be the American way, you are an elite. You are a cultural elite, you are a snob, and you are closed-minded. We have got to learn to see things outside of the American story, outside of the American picture. And in the ancient world, in the ancient Middle East, everyone understood the shedding of blood, and there was a regular shedding of blood in the context of your religion or your spirituality, whatever it was. It's very interesting how many religions and spiritualities have things in common. This doesn't mean that all religions and spiritualities are the same, but it does mean that as human beings who are created in the image of God, we have the story of God that's grafted in us, and we all understand to some degree that we have fallen short of who God is. We have angered God, the quote-unquote, the gods must be angry. And so all ancient peoples, many peoples today, have sacrifice. Have sacrifice as a way to appease gods. And so Abraham, when he hears about taking son and sacrificing, he's actually probably not all that thrown off by it. In that, he's seen this happen. Sacrifices all over. People are always going up on mountains closer to where they view the gods and sacrificing things. And people in some cultures would actually sacrifice children. He doesn't like it. He's probably surprised that his God's asking him to do this because he's thinking, wow, this really doesn't line up with the God that I thought that I knew, the one who talked to me, especially given the fact that this is part of the promise. This is really strange to me, not out of bounds for what divinity does, but just strange. All right, I guess I need to do this, even though he doesn't want to. And God obviously knows he doesn't want to. He teased it out. It's a test. It's a test that he gives Abraham. Your child, and he builds it. Your only child. And then he builds it more. Whom you love. Yes, I get it, Abraham. This is very, very difficult. I want you to take him up on the mountain, and I want you to sacrifice him. God is giving him instructions, and whenever God gives instructions, he gives structure. God gives structure. God faithfully gives. His faithfulness demands him to give structure. If you're a parent, and you are faithful to your child, you will give your kid structure. You will give them rules. You will give them regulations. You will give them standards, not because you get to feel all high and powerful, but because you know more than them. You know how life works. They don't. And if you don't give structure, then you are not faithful as a parent. And God faithfully gives structure. Now, when we draw on the parent-child relationship, it gets a little difficult for us in America because our American story is all about the exaltation of the child. It's unique to the American story. Even in other societies today, this is not the way it is in America as it is other places. In America, this child, if you have a child, is always supreme. What the child wants, you give. Then we have helicopter moms, helicopter dads who just kind of hover around, or no sacrifice is too great for a kid. A lot of this is good, but ultimately we have child-centered homes. We put the child at the top of the pecking list in terms of meeting needs and all that kind of stuff. It's not the way it is in other cultures. That's one of the things we've learned over in South Africa. Not the way at all. In fact, children are nobodies in South Africa. Utter nobodies. And I'm not saying they're right, we're wrong, we're right, they're wrong. All I'm saying is even our approach to a story like this is influenced by the story that we live in right now and our values. American story is all about exalting the child, no matter what the kid wants. And when you come into God's story, you have to look at things critically and you think, is this what God would want or not? I know for Liv and I, we've made some hard choices that we just haven't done things that our kids would want, that other kids would have, because we have not chosen not to have our kids at the center of the story. One example for us, and that was just awesome, you just have to figure out your own example for you if you're a parent, but we had one of our kids play soccer 1 year, and they weren't that bad, but we had to conveniently miss the signups the next year. We said, we know where this is going. My goodness, we see this. The soccer thing is just going to monopolize our life, and before you know it, 12 years are gone. Every spare waking leisure hour gone, and I'm sorry, we just don't like soccer that much. So we never did anything to encourage soccer in our kids at all. You might do that. You might love soccer. I'm not saying there's anything bad against it, but I am saying this. When you get grafted into God's story, you will notice things that are within your own cultural story that could be unhealthy, and you just do it. You change. You go against the grain, whatever that is. We as Americans get upset about the tiger mom. You might have heard about tiger mom. Written a book, been on talk shows, an Asian woman who just is driving her kids to succeed, driving them to get better, driving them to advance, to go up, 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 up. Not letting her kids have any sleepovers at all because it takes away from practicing the piano and grades. tells her kids that B is a failure. It's an utter failure. Drives them to succeed. And American moms, American parents are being threatened. We don't like this. And I don't think the tiger mom is necessarily healthy or she's right, but she actually is tied into a Middle Eastern, yes, Asian mom, Middle East, an ancient Middle East perspective that says children are here to serve the whole. Children are here, and I need to drive them to be the best they can because as they succeed, we all succeed. We in America, we want our kids to succeed, and then they go off to California and make it, and we see them once or twice a year. Our kids bettering themselves doesn't affect the family whole at all. In the ancient world, as the family went, so everybody went. As the family went well, everybody went well. So it was a preservation of the family, the community, at all costs. So when Isaac is to be sacrificed, when Abraham says Isaac be sacrificed, this isn't just an emotional, oh, you're kidding, my only son. This isn't just an emotional crushing blow. This is the death of a vision. This is the death of a promise. The oldest son would get the lion's share of the inheritance. Again, in the American story, we want to treat everybody equally, so we water out our wealth to everybody. And this is why great families of the past are irrelevant today, such as the Vanderbilts. They watered out their family. They got away from folks in the railroads and having one patriarch that would take care of the whole family. They would never do this in the ancient world, many parts of the world today. They want to keep the wealth focused in one individual who isn't about them getting ahead, but takes care of the entire family, takes care of the whole thing. And we have to see God. By the way, I hate going ahead in the story, but I just have to do this. At certain points, you're going to notice here, oh, the firstborn. Isn't Jesus called the firstborn? Can't help it. I'm going to jump forward maybe one other time today. But this is the death of a vision, the one who's supposed to be the standard bearer, the one who actually takes care of things. Middle Eastern societies understand this. And God gives structure to how things are to work. When the nation of Israel later on gets advanced, they start growing, they have problem after problem after problem. They get put into slavery, and as they come out of slavery in Egypt, Moses leads them through a miraculous parting. God faithfully parts a sea, and then God gives them structure. He gives them the Ten Commandments, and here's what it says in the Ten Commandments, the very beginning, Exodus chapter 20, and God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods for me is the first commandment. So what is the context for the structure that God gives? Whether it's the structure of the Ten Commandments, whether it's the structure that we see in the Bible of how a legal system is to operate for the nation of Israel, or what's healthy or what's unhealthy, the structure is one of gratitude towards God's faithfulness. I'm the Lord who brought you out of slavery. See, the reason last week is so critical, understanding the bad news, understanding our brokenness, is if you and I don't see ourselves as slaves to sin, if we don't see ourselves as slaves to brokenness, if we don't see ourselves as unworthy, if we've never wrestled with that, we will constantly feel entitled and think that God owes us something, and we will never see him as faithful. We are slaves. We're slaves. And the Spirit said, man, we are slaves. Make no doubt about it. We are lost. We are in a pit without any help. And God came and brought us to a new place. And that reformats for me the structure. It's not the killjoy who's trying to put me down, but out of gratitude and knowing that he's got a plan, I want to graft into that plan. Until we see the reality of our brokenness, we'll not be able to see the reality of God's faithfulness, how grand it is. In our community, in our American community, we have such a hard time with issues because we constantly see things from an individual self-sufficiency perspective. So on the political scene, on the right wing of Republicans, it's all about rugged individualism. You hear that talk about rugged individualism. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Don't expect anybody else to do it for you. Go out and make hay, rugged individualism. And then on the opposite side, perhaps on the left wing of the Democrat Party, well, there's a lot of talk about individual rights. Don't do anything that's going to hurt anybody or give somebody some shot, no matter where they are. It's individual rights. What's the common theme? Actually, they're both the same story. What's the common theme? Individual. Individual. We never think in a community well-being perspective. We never think of sacrificing for the whole. Well, if you're on the right, if you're on the left, if you're in the middle, notice what's happening right now in the political discussion. We pretty much now universally agreed that financial Armageddon is coming. We cannot keep funding our basic operating costs every year with a credit line that increases and increases. We have looming stuff that's in our front. It does not look good. We can't keep pushing. Something must happen quick. We're all realizing this, but we can't identify with what it is. Why is that? It's because no one, in an individual sense, wants to do anything for the collective whole, because we are wired for my individual story, for my individual dreams, for what why I individually do. And I can be expected to sacrifice the greater good. So if you're higher income as an individual, any talk about a higher income rate on you, no, absolutely not. No. If you're lower income, any thought about changing welfare programs, no. If you're pro-military, either because you like the strong American might or because with your family or your small town, it's a way for people to have solid employment or whatever, oh, don't come back to the military. No. Or if you're doing okay, but my goodness, you're 55. And you're about ready to go into social. Go, oh, can't push back Social Security. Can't do that. And if you're, I can go on and on and on. We all are okay about the idea of change, just as long as it doesn't affect me. Just as long as I don't have to do anything. Because we've always been exalted as children. We're all, the whole self-help industry says it's all about you. And along comes God and says, no, it's not about you. It's about me. It's about my community, the people that I'm building. Is why we are so frequently out of step with understanding God and experiencing His joy and His faithfulness. So Abraham has a test. He decides to march forward, and here's where it goes. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. And he carried the fire and the knife. And as the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and the wood is here," Isaac said, "but where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Isaac has seen this drill before. He's been around. He's seen a lot of sacrifices. He knows the drill. Okay, there's the sharp instrument that's going to be used to slit the throat of the lamb or the goat or whatever it is. Here's the wood that's going to be used to kindle it. We're going uphill because these things happen on top of a mountain. You know, I get this. Not, I understand what's happening, but one thing's missing. Where's the lamb? Where's the lamb? As he's carrying the wood himself up, where's the lamb? And Abraham says, "God will provide the lamb." Can't help it. I'm going to go forward one more time. The firstborn on the way to sacrifice, carrying the wood on his own back, just like the firstborn of all creation. We're going to see soon Jesus himself carrying the own wood on his back, the cross, on the way to a sacrifice. And Abraham is holding out hope here that this could end differently. He said, "God will provide." He may be not wanting to give his son the full truth and say, "Dude, I'm sorry, you're the sacrifice." Or he may be holding out hope that God's going to have a reprieve and a plan B that he doesn't know about. But he's moving forward. He's moving forward, and he is holding out for grace. And God's faithfulness does give grace. Grace is all about something that I haven't earned, that I haven't worked for, but out of God's faithfulness, I get something. He's holding out that God is going to do something that he hasn't planned and experienced. The nation of Israel will experience God's grace throughout their whole history. We think that God in the Old Testament is not a God of grace. What Old Testament do you read? My goodness. Over and over again, he gives grace. Gives animal skins when no one had thought about that before. Gives grace by saying, "You, I'm going to do something great in you." When they're in slavery, gives grace by miraculously taking them out. And whether they're in slavery to Babylon, Persia, he puts the right person in the right time to avert disaster. Whether it's Esther, a great-looking Jewish woman who, because of her looks, comes into the king's household and she can find out about a disaster that's happening to eliminate Jews, and she's able to step in. Or whether it's food that drops from heaven that people don't have and they supernaturally are able to eat and go forward. Or what, I mean, I go on and on and on. God regularly and consistently gives things that people haven't earned and haven't even thought of. And I hope you do that every once in a while. Think through, what are the things that God has given you out of grace? His grace. Right now, all of our hearts are beating, depending on how in shape you are, either 45 times a minute or 75 times a minute. None of us have thought about that little electric charge that's just gone like clockwork. It's a sign of grace. None of us have earned our hearts to beat, yet they're beating. And it's in the background. We don't even think about it. When I have a meal, I say grace. Sometimes it's a very silent prayer in the context of 2 seconds. Sometimes with the family holding hands, and we say grace, meaning all this stuff here, I've never had to kill anything and eat it. We are so detached from blood in our society that we can't even see blood. We eat things that used to have blood in them, but we've never killed anything. We're so grossed out by the basics of the way the humankind has operated. And I eat that, and it's a sign of grace. Or my salad, it's a sign of grace because God gave me the ability to have money to buy it. I can identify times in my life where I should have died. At least 2 times I should be dead. And it's out of God's grace that I'm here. It's God's grace that enabled me to get adopted into a family that had a value on education. I came out of school without any school debt and a great 2.1 grade average. It was God's grace that enabled me. Why me? That's ridiculous. Why a guy? I don't know. But you know, you have things probably that somebody else doesn't have that you never work for. You do. You have things. You have problems that other people don't have either. But all of us have signs of grace, and we have to take inventory of those things. How in this vast, massive story of God, He still does things for the individual, things of blessing. He gives grace. And so Abraham is holding out that God is going to show up. And verse 10 says this, "Then he reached out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, 'Abraham, Abraham.' 'Here I am,' he replied. 'Do not lay a hand on the boy,' he said. 'Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son.'" Now I know. And actually, Abraham looks over, and there's a ram that's caught in the thickets. He unties his son, he goes over, gets the ram, puts him right back on top of where the wood pile is. They slay the ram, and they burn the ram, remembering that God has shown up, God has given grace. And what does God say? God says, "Now I know." It's weird. It's as if God is saying, "Now I've added to my knowledge base that may change my future behavior. Now I know." He said it was a test. Now I know. He was saying, "Abraham, are you more in love with your preferred reality? Are you more in love with your family beautiful? Or are you more in love with my family? Are you more in love with your preferred story, or are you more in love with my story?" And the thing that Abraham went through is the same thing all of us go through, though fortunately none of us are ever going to probably ask to sacrifice a child. Extreme thing. In the midst of all of this that God is, here's you. Right there. There you are. Can you see you? No, you can't. I hate to break it to you, but you're really insignificant. I'm really insignificant, very insignificant. That's why I don't get any motivational speaking gigs. They pay really well. I figure a few of them. Hey, that'll motivate you. You are a nobody. In the span of all that is and all that, you're really non-consequential, inconsequential, whatever it is. I told you out of 2-1. You really are, just not, you're just, really, what is that? We are so small, so finite. In the grand scheme of God, and yet He still notices, He still gives us structure, He still gives us grace. And we ought to pull out from the scratch to see the entire story. And if we were able to do that, life would start to make sense. It really would. We'd be able to properly categorize failures. We'd be able to properly categorize our successes. But as it is, our story puts us at the center of the scratch. We love the scratch. We wake up in the morning, we have our scratch oatmeal, we go to our scratch jobs so we can scratch a little living for ourselves. We get to our scratch weekends, we have our scratch vacations, our scratch dreams. We have our scratch hopes to retire someday, to live and just scratch on the sand or in the golf course. We live for the scratch. We fixate on the scratch. Everything is about the scratch, and it is just a scratch. It's a scratch. The day you see the faithfulness of God, the grace of God, and are able to zoom out to the thing that He includes us in is the day that life starts to make sense. But so long as we kind of scratch out our living on a day-by-day basis, trying to get to what's owed us or trying to get ourselves ahead, life will be frustrating. And even if we're successful, life will not endure. God is faithful. God does not give up. He will not give up on what He's doing, nor on you.